We'll point out the Lansing State Journal is reporting today that the head of the Lansing Board of Water and Light, Peter Lark, says the utility will adopt more than 100 recommendations outlined in the Independent Community Review Team's report. General Manager Peter Lark spoke to members of the BWL's Board of Commissioners yesterday. He said the organizational problems that plagued the utility at the time of last December's historic ice storm were much deeper than he initially acknowledged. Lark says implementing the recommendations is going to be costly, though, and that ratepayers should expect to see cost increases. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're along today. Once every 4 years, hundreds of millions of soccer fans get swept up in the excitement of the World Cup. The month-long spectacle begins play tomorrow in Brazil. The event's not just about sport, though. It's also an exercise in politics and international relations, particularly for the host country, which could see both positive and negative side effects from hosting the game. Dr. Peter Alleggi is Michigan State University's resident expert on the World Cup. He's a professor in the Department of History and author of several books which explore the social and political side of soccer, including Africa's World Cup, Critical Reflections on Play, Patriotism, Spectatorship, and Space. Dr. Alleggi, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
To understand the political aspects of the World Cup, I guess we first have to really understand FIFA. Could you give us an abridged version of what FIFA is all about?
FIFA is not just a video game. It is the world governing body of soccer, and it is a nonprofit international NGO based in Zurich, Switzerland, and it owns the World Cup, from which it accumulates about 90%+ of its revenue.
Mm-hmm. But officially a nonprofit.
Officially a nonprofit.
So during the last World Cup in South Africa, or this year's in Brazil, what are the obligations of the host country to FIFA?
Well, the main obligations is to deliver a tournament that satisfies the very exacting demands and requirements of FIFA. And the most important thing, of course, is to provide world-class stadiums in which the games will take place, the transportation and telecommunication infrastructure, and everything that goes with organizing the tournament. These are all spelled out in minute detail in legal agreements that the host nation has to sign with FIFA. And these are obviously binding. And as I said, these are very exacting, and it's a costly arrangement for the host nations, but it's a very remunerative one, a profitable one for FIFA.
What does FIFA gain?
Well, in the last World Cup in South Africa in 2010, according to FIFA's own financial statements, the organization earned over $2.3 billion U.S. in profit tax-free.
But there are people who argue that the financial gains from the event are not fairly distributed. I take it that is an ongoing debate.
There's no question that the agreement is unequal in terms of the hosting arrangements. FIFA walks away with all these tax-free profits, some of which are reinvested in the game, but quite a bit of those profits end up simply in their bank accounts. But for the host nations, it's usually a financial loss. In South Africa's case, you know, the conservative estimate of the expenses that the country incurred in were about $7 billion U.S., right? So very few countries have been able to break even, let alone make a small profit from hosting the World Cup. So really what they're doing is paying for a massive global advertising campaign for their countries.
But in the end, there is a fair amount of competition to host the World Cup. In the end, despite the financial losses, is it arguable that it's worth it, or is there a consensus that it's not?
Well, I'm not sure about a consensus, but what seems to be happening is that politicians around the world and their corporate partners seem to agree that the emotional benefits that a country gets from these tournaments are worth the expense. And by that, I mean both the political gains that come out of it, particularly national unity, strengthen national pride and patriotism, You know, those are quite valuable. Selling the country to tourists and foreign investors is seen as an incredibly worthwhile pursuit. But I think there's also an emerging consensus that, yeah, financially, these are not going to work out. Mm. And in Brazil, we're starting to see already, starting last year, that citizens are quite upset with this kind of an arrangement.
There are other challenges facing the host countries. During the last World Cup in South Africa, there were special measure acts passed, which in some ways actually, I'm told, actually weakened the host country's sovereignty during the month of the World Cup in order to protect FIFA's interest. Can you tell us more about that?
So part of the host nation agreements that FIFA makes the host nation sign is the requirement that laws be passed to protect FIFA's financial interests. And these include the special World Cup laws. In South Africa, as you said, those Special Measures Act were passed. And what those do primarily is they set up these kind of extraterritorial zones for FIFA within about a mile and a half from the venues of the World Cup matches. And within those zones, right, your national sovereignty is temporarily surrendered to this transnational organization called FIFA, as well as the constitutional rights of the citizens of the host nation are surrendered. In the case of South Africa, you know, one thinks of a country where they struggled so hard and sacrificed so much for almost 50 years to defeat apartheid, to bring about freedom and democracy. And for 30 days, they gave up those hard-earned rights in order to have a successful and peaceful FIFA World Cup. Yeah. And so that the corporations that sponsor it, right, have their business interests protected.
Extraordinary. Have similar measures been passed in Brazil for this year's World Cup, similar to what we just talked about in South Africa?
Yes, in Brazil, it's called the General Law of the World Cup. And not only are these same exclusion zones set up around the venues and in certain cities around Brazil, but also there are special tribunals in place so that violations, whether they be fans misbehaving or whether it's ambush marketing where particular sponsors are trying to insinuate themselves into the competition zone, even though they're not official partners, they are processed more quickly than they would otherwise be in the special tribunal and dealt with by the judicial system in Brazil. So, very much the same kinds of laws have been passed in the case of Brazil. And what I find really concerning here is not so much the attention paid to crowd safety, which of course, you know, is paramount, but also how this provides a bit of an excuse for future events in which the constitutional rights of people could be temporarily suspended and the national sovereignty of a particular country given up.
Have there been serious rights violations, in your view, due to these kinds of laws so far, or are you more concerned about the future?
Well, in the case of South Africa, there weren't any large-scale violations, but there were some worrying instances. For example, a colleague of mine when I was teaching as a Fulbright scholar at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, he was distributing pamphlets at a FIFA fan park where games are screened on a large screen for people who can't get or don't want to go to the games at the stadium. And he was arrested because the police said that in the FIFA zone, he had no free speech rights. Right. So that did happen. Mm-hmm. And in the Brazilian case, some of the violations really that are more egregious have to do with the forced evictions of poor people from the favelas, the poor neighborhoods in and around the stadiums and other venues.
Our guest is Dr. Peter Alleggi, who's on the faculty here at Michigan State University and who is an expert and written several books about soccer and the World Cup. As I'm sure many have seen in the news, there have been street protests over the event in Brazil against FIFA. Are protests like this typical during a World Cup in the host country?
Not really typical, no. I think they're increasing, though, because of the fact that so much public money, taxpayer money, is being spent to host these essentially corporate sports spectacles. So no, they're not typical, although they have happened in the past. And in some cases, the human rights violations were quite horrible. The most famous, perhaps, is that in 1968 in Mexico City, where on the eve of those famous or perhaps infamous Olympics, right, hundreds of people were shot in one of the main squares in Mexico City, and the blood had just been wiped off the plaza when the athletes started arriving. Mm.
What impact do you think this tension will have on the event in Brazil overall?
That's hard to say. I think, you know, last night, I believe it was the president of Brazil, Rousseff, went on TV and gave a big primetime speech defending the Brazil's hosting of the World Cup. And it seemed to me that a lot is going to hinge on the performance of the Brazilian team. In other words, if Brazil ends up winning their sixth World Cup, then I think the legacy of this tournament is going to be perceived as a positive one, and there's going to be massive celebration in the way that only Brazilians know how to celebrate, with lots of dancing and partying. But if Brazil does not win, I think there's a real risk for a political uprising in Brazil.
Really? You alluded to the dislocation of a lot of poor people to make way for the facilities in Brazil for this year's World Cup. Ironically, at such large world events in the past, a lot of these facilities sometimes become ruins afterwards. Is that the case with the World Cup as well? Can you point to facilities that are in ruins now?
Certainly, there's evidence from past World Cups that happened. In South Korea, for instance, in 2002, several of the stadiums that hosted World Cup games became so-called white elephants, and a couple of them have been demolished already. The South Koreans decided to cut their losses, and rather than continue to maintain facilities that weren't being used, they got rid of them. In South Africa, in 2010, they built five brand new stadiums. They refurbished five. Only two of the 10 stadiums used in South Africa in 2010 are used regularly, week in and week out, by professional soccer teams in that country. In Brazil, there are at least four venues that are at serious risk of becoming white elephants, including, you know, stadiums built in Amazonia, like the one in Manaus, where the local amateur team or semi-professional team only draws about 1,000, 2,000 people a game. And now they have a 42,000-seat stadium that we know is not going to be sustainable. The same in the city of Natal, in Cuiabá, and even in the capital, Brasilia, where the local team draws very few spectators, and they have a massive, you know, stadium of 70,000 seats, where, you know, they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this beautiful facility that is in that curvaceous modernist style, as David Goldblatt puts it, of the city of Brasilia that Oscar Niemeyer, the famous architect, constructed, right? And it's just going to sit there empty. And it's really quite predictable and therefore hard to explain, including to the citizens of Brazil.
Is there any credible discussion within FIFA to address reforms, to launch reforms, to address any of these issues that we've been talking about?
The key word there is credible.
So they do acknowledge it up to a point that reforms are necessary, but they're not serious?
I don't think so. I think what kind of reform they talk about is really a public relations exercise. And they're very good at that. They're extremely sophisticated. And as you and I are speaking here to this morning, FIFA is holding its Congress in Brazil. It's being streamed live. So if listeners want to go and see how FIFA operates, just go to their website, FIFA.com, and you can watch the proceedings. And it's really not an institution that's going to change from within, although the president, Sepp Blatter, has an opponent for next year's presidential elections, who Jérôme Champagne, a former French diplomat and former ally of Blatter, who is actively campaigning on a reformist platform. But if you look at the nitty-gritty of that reformist agenda, it's hard to see how it's going to be really transformational.
Very interesting. This was just on the BBC World News last night, the challenge that the current president of FIFA is undergoing as a result of this. It's at least getting more publicity, the controversy. Globally, Brazil's national identity is so tied up with football, as you alluded to a minute ago. Of the eight countries who have won the World Cup, Brazil has the most wins. How might Brazil's national identity be impacted by the games?
In a brand new book entitled The Country of Football, which is how most of the world refers to soccer, of course. The historian Roger Kittleson makes a really interesting argument about how this World Cup is trying to forge a new kind of Brazilian identity. And he links it very closely to two things. One, he links it to this idea of tropical modernity, which I find quite appealing, right? This country that is part of the BRICS club, along with
Brazil, Russia, India, China.
And South Africa.
In South Africa, BRICS, right.
And, you know, putting forth a strikingly different image of the global South, or at least the countries outside of the traditional, you know, great powers club, a country that combines the cultural vibrancy that one often finds in the global South with all of the technological and business sophistication of that we associate with modernity. The other thing that the Brazilians apparently are trying to do, according to Kittleson, is to emphasize the kind of inclusive nature of Brazilian society and culture, a sense of Brazilianness that is accepting of all its people, whether they are of white or mixed race or black background, or whether they are rich or poor, what have you, a kind of rainbow nationalism that, to my mind, reminded me a lot of what South Africa tried to do in 2010 to bring back that spirit of Nelson Mandela, that spirit of reconciliation and progress and healing.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Peter Alleggi is a Michigan State University resident expert on the World Cup. Beyond his many books on football, he also runs the blog Football is Coming Home. Dr. Alleggi, thanks.
Thank you.